Welcome to another episode of the Digital Identity Podcast. I'm your co-host, Terry Lin, and I have Ben with me today. Today, Carlos, who's usually with us, is out in Phuket. Where is he? He's taking a break.
Yeah. He's at the beach drinking coconuts and all that.
God, being a coconut cowboy. All right. So today, we're going to talk about digital identity, DIDs, and also kind of how it relates to paper-based systems and how this can be kind of a future system that we can adopt as this technology advances. So before we start, we're going to start with kind of something called a spam and scam segment. So what's funny is that I was talking to Ben earlier before the call. Both of us were kind of victims of identity scams this week. So we're going to go over that real quick.
I don't know if victim is the right word. I mean, definitely targeted, but potential victim, sure. I have a Google Ads account, right? So that I run some Google ad campaigns through. I had been getting these missed calls for about a week from different numbers in Singapore. And they would call between like 1 and 4 in the morning, about 3 times a day or whatever, right? About a week later, I got some emails from a guy who said he was my quote unquote account manager. There's a problem with my account, my AdWords account. I've tried reaching you by phone a few times, thought email might be a more convenient way to touch base. Your ads are showing in out of targeted locations, and there's a few important updates that Google has rolled out that we need to install on your account.
Was it actually from a Google email or?
It was from a Google email, and that was like the first thing I checked. So I mean, like, whatever, he's got like fake signature or whatever, right? But he was like sending it from an email that says at google.com. So I'm not sure exactly how that works. I mean, Google's a big company, so maybe there's somebody who's working like kind of like in a low level role there, who's like helping to like facilitate the scammers or something, or there's some other way to like spoof that. That sent from domain still. I said, like, are you the person who's calling me at between 1 and 4 in the morning? Like, can you please stop? He emails me back and says, no, I only called 3 times, you know, between 8 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, I live in Thailand, so that's exactly 1 and 4 in the morning. Like, way to go, right?
Yeah.
And so then he like reintroduces himself as my quote unquote account manager. And he wants to quickly correct these errors on the account so that, you know, it will increase performance and decrease costs. I was like, oh, okay, great. So like, can you tell me like more details about this? He's like, no, I can't tell you more details over email. We have to, you know, discuss this over the phone. And then at that point, I was like, okay, whatever. I've just, you know, deleted it. Like, or I didn't answer him basically, right?
All right, cool. So my story was I've been trying to sell some stuff on eBay, and I've been getting these not bids, but offers, the DMs, like, hey, you know, what are you trying to sell this for? And then here's my email. Let's take this outside of eBay so you don't have to pay fees. And it's like a screenshot of an email with a phone number. And what happened was that eBay now, they scan messages for like emails or phone numbers. So if people try to take it offline, they don't get the fee, right? So the people are trying to like, one, they've taken old accounts, probably when eBay was hacked back in the day, because a lot of these messages are coming from people that had accounts since like 2008, 2009, probably been dormant for a bit. And so they're using this to contact sellers and probably to get people to send them the merchandise and then like never send the money. Or something like that too. So, but it's interesting because both of these issues, they're like identity issues, right? Like, how do you prove you are who you are, and how can I trust you based on what you say, right? Like the guy trying to impersonate someone from Google, he has a script he's following, and it's like an @google.com email, which may or may not be like a real one, but usually it's a pretty scam because the real one would just be google.com, right? So, and it's interesting because even the eBay situation for me, they've taken over real accounts from people, but the way they presented it, whether it's through, like, through the text they've been writing, it's like a copy paste script that you can tell. And even like the screen, like why would you screenshot your email address and phone number? It just makes no sense, right? And obviously you're trying to hide something instead of just typing it, right? So it's like these kind of scams are super interesting that, you know, if we do have like a digital ID system where we can just bypass all this, you know, it'll be nice if it goes away.
That's right. If we look at like solutions, right? So, okay, here's the problem, you know, obviously like, I just had to go through sort of this experience very recently. Some people are not so lucky, right? Like, they'll get caught up in it and it can do some real damage. One way that we could do this, and now we've talked a little bit about DIDs before, right? Which are decentralized identifiers. Let's say, for example, if Google had implemented a DID system that was, let's say it was multi-sig, right? So it was a multi-sig DID that had some sort of like, permissioning mechanism into it or something, right? This guy could contact me and he could say, okay, I'm your account manager at Google. right? I say, okay, great. Can you send me like a signature, you know, proving that or whatever, right? So let's say, you know, if they did have this DID system, you know, they would have to send me a valid signature that proves like, you know, ownership of that DID. And if you had it like in a corporate sort of multi-sig wallet, it would require more than one person, right? So it'd be, right, you know, him and then like his boss or his manager or something, right? Like they both have to sign off on it. So something like that, like using cryptography, like that's sort of an issue, right? As long as like there was a sort of a system in place that we all sort of accepted, right?
It would prove ownership of identity instead of just being like an email that looks like it's trying to spoof a real Google email, essentially.
And for the average person to like go through like the detective work to figure out like if an email was like fake or not, it's not simple, right? And then even then still, like if it was like just like a really good fake or whatever, if they had some way to sort of, you know, bypass these things, then, you know, that too is not, it's not foolproof, right? But if you had public cryptographically sort of secured, you know, decentralized identity system that was out there and it had like, you know, permissioning mechanisms, it had multi-sig, that would be a lot harder to prove, like, or sorry, a lot harder to spoof and try and use in a scam or something, right? And then it'd be done right there. It's like, prove that you work at Google, you either can or you can't, right? You know?
Yeah. I think one thing that's interesting about DIDs is that, will it actually be called DIDs for mainstream adoption? Because really, like the internet, it was called what? Information highway, information network.
And yeah.
DID still sounds kind of very technical. Cyberspace. Like in 5 years, will it still be called DID? Because like if you say DID to anyone, like, well, what does DID stand for?
I think it could stick. I mean, because we say ID already, right? So I mean, it's just one extra letter. I think that one's
exactly.
That one's okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that's super far out that kind of the market, I guess, will decide. But
I think you could do a lot worse. I've seen a lot worse ideas as far as naming goes. Yeah.
So let's go into a little bit about paper-based systems, because I think we need to set a basis of what we're used to on a day-to-day basis, and then we can kind of go into how DIDs, what they offer on a very high level, and how that's different too, right? Before this episode, I was thinking about like a paper-based system. What IDs do you have? You have your passport.
Yeah.
Maybe a driver's license, diploma, utility bill, and birth certificate, all this stuff, right? But they all kind of prove different things about you. And so what's the drawback here? Because if you look at digital systems, this is not compatible, right? Like, what roadblocks does this create?
Okay, I'll give you an example. Have you ever tried to get like a copy of your diploma, let's say, like your high school or like a university diploma?
Kind of that.
That is school pain. Like, holy, yeah. that is not easy. It was easier for me to get a passport, like to renew a passport or something. Definitely the speed, right? So I mean, if all of that's digital using like blockchain or something, it's definitely going to be faster. And then again, like you go back to using DIDs as a solution, right? You know, if each institution that is responsible for issuing these documents, if they have a DID system, right, sign off on something, you know, digitally, and it can be sort of cryptographically traced back to them to show that this is them.
One thing with diplomas too is that you can have a diploma, but if you sometimes gotta go to different countries, it's not like resolvable between different jurisdictions, which is kind of annoying too.
Yeah, I don't know if that would be solved with digital so much. I think that's more like about the actual agreements that like different organizations within countries have. Like I think was it like accreditation standards, right?
Given that it's paper, it just makes it more difficult to be recognized in different areas.
Sure.
Because you have to bring it around. And if it's not in the right language, like someone's reading English, well, how do I know you didn't fake this diploma?
Yeah,
just exactly. Graduated from like Harvard or wherever, too, right? Even like you can make a flick diploma too. I mean, yeah.
There was a guy in China. There was a real high profile case about using like some like fake PhD from Harvard, and he was like a CEO of like a big company in China, right?
Cultures like that where like it carries out a weight,
yeah,
what school you went to, yeah. And it's almost like a caste system of what it determines where you are in like certain aspects of society.
I mean, like Western countries used to be like that too, right? You know, like if you even just go back like 20 or 30 years ago, like, you know, if you didn't have like a BA, you're just like destined to be a construction worker like for the rest of your life. Right?
So one thing that is also interesting is that these paper-based IDs expire, right? And so if we move to a digital system, it stays there forever, which is kind of interesting because you look at how many times you have to renew a passport. Every 10 years for the US, I don't know how much is it for Canada.
Yeah, well, it depends still. It could be 5 or 10 years. That being said, however, on the digital system, you can implement expiries as well, because sometimes you don't want something to last forever or be valid forever, right? So yeah, there's nothing to stop us from adding expiry dates or time constraints or around the validity of one of these like, you know, online claims or something like that.
Right. Like say you have a tourist visa for 30 days, you could just set it to expire.
Yeah.
on-chain.
Exactly. But there's also the benefit of having something that doesn't expire too, right? So, I mean, if we're able to implement that. So again, we go back to the example of the DID. You could keep that forever. The data that you have associated with that DID could be subject to all different kinds of parameters, right? Including expiry dates. I've seen this sort of a digital work permit basically that replaces the paper one, and you download an app onto your phone, and then it's got sort of like, you know, your picture and then like your name and your info and stuff, right? And it's even got this cool little thing where if you tilt it, it uses the gyroscope in your iPhone to like make like some background like holograms appear.
Huh.
Yeah. So that way, like if you try and do a screenshot of it and like you're trying to show like just the screenshot image, it won't work. You have to have the app, and it has to be like actually connected. Right. So I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know how foolproof that is, but it's definitely an interesting mechanism.
Yeah, because how do you screenshot something that's digital and not make sure it's like non-fungible or copyable?
Well, that's just it, right? I mean, like for something normal, it would be really, really easy to just, you know, take a screenshot and then show somebody the picture of that, and they'll just be like, yep. It's hard to build something that's totally, totally foolproof. And that's why I think there's so much promise and stuff that's built around sort of the decentralized ledgers and cryptography, because that helps move things towards a state where it's more and more difficult to basically like pull off like a scam.
All right, so let's go into kind of the four characteristics of DIDs. We kind of just have some quick outlines here. We're not going to get too technical, but I think it's important to understand that how we're using the paper system now, the drawbacks there, and where this can potentially be solved with the digital system. So I'm going to go through these characteristics, and then Ben, let's have you talk about them. And so the first one is persistence. So what does this mean?
Because it's important to understand that the DID is a reference, right? You know, so you want to be able to always reference back to that DID and have it be the same, no matter if everything else can change around it. Like, you know, let's say if like we're associating authentication mechanisms or, you know, key management or anything like that, you know, our service endpoints, all of those should be able to be rotated, right? You know, key rotation is an important part of security, right? You know, all of that can change entirely, but the DID itself should be persistent throughout that whole process, right? So that should stay the same. So that's what I mean by persistence.
And I guess a reference that DIDs can work with different blockchains too, right? Because you can then route different requests based on where you have different things stored too. So it's kind of like an umbrella on top of this that can then kind of hold everything together, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's diving into like interoperability and concepts like that. There's not really an accepted industry standard. You know, everyone's working together and trying to build these standards and, you know, like cooperating with like the work groups and all of that. But we're not quite there at the point where everything is, you know, crystal clear in terms of how that's actually meant to work in the real world here. But we're getting there.
I think it's kind of like how the internet was started out, right? Everyone had to figure out the standards for that, right? Like the HTTP standards and everything too.
Yeah.
Which you don't even think about these days. You just kind of type in a website and then it just works, right?
Yeah, and you could compare that to other protocols like like IRC or Telnet or something like.
So that kind of brings me into the second point, which is called being resolvable. So what's the deal with this?
From a practical standpoint, we can say that we can take a DID, resolve a DID document, and then the DID document should have some information related to that DID. So if we look at the W3C spec for DIDs, you go right to the bottom. There's this great thing called the Advanced DID Real World Example. And so you've got the DID, obviously, in there, and then you have these different sections for public key, authentication, service endpoints, right? And then they'll all have some information within that. That's what we mean by when we resolve it. So you can take that string, run it through a resolver, and then that will build a document that will have some information that is associated with that DID. And ideally, you'd be able to take action on some of that information. So let's say if there were some service endpoints in there. One example could be you had a service endpoint for an identity hub. Get someone's DID, resolve their DID into a DID document, and get back a list of service endpoints. Inside the list of service endpoints is a service endpoint for an identity hub. You could then communicate with that identity hub and like put in a request for like a document or a piece of data from that identity hub.
Yeah, how would this work in like a diploma example that we've been kind of running with?
For the diploma example, maybe you could have a service endpoint that would reference your diploma. Let's say like the university you went to had an identity hub, then you could sort of like, you know, send a request to that identity hub, say like, okay, could you send me back, maybe not the actual document, but like a verification, the person who's like associated with this DID basically verify that that credential is true.
Check if Ben actually went to this university, and there would be a protocol.
I didn't. Yeah, no. I can already answer that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So next point, cryptographically variable. Let's talk about this one a little bit.
In our case, for the Selkie method, it is built on Ethereum. You could create a signature with an Ethereum address if that Ethereum address is in control of that DID, and then use the signature to prove ownership of it. So that's actually pretty simple, that part. It just sort of depends on, you know, the actual like technology underlying the specific DID, you know, like what protocol it's running on. It's just like your private key for your Ether address, right? Like if you're trying to make a transaction, if I want to send you some key tokens or something, right? I have to sign that transaction. So it's the same process, more or less.
Okay, cool. So last but not least, it has to be decentralized. Why is this important?
The key thing is they cannot revoke the DID, right? So, you know, let's say like we put up a smart contract that allows like you to register a DID. So it's like, okay, I've got an Ether address. I want to go create a DID. So I hit the smart contract, send a little gas, and then you know, I get back a DID, right? And then that gets registered on the ledger. In the true like decentralized system, nobody else is going to be able to take that down, like except for me,
right?
You know, so if I want to, I can delete it, but no one else should be able to, right? Whereas if you compare that to like, again, we're talking about the paper-based models and like a centralized system, the government could just revoke my passport or revoke my driver's license and I would not be able to do anything about it, right? You know,
that's happened, you know, in the US, some IRS people that didn't pay their taxes, they just get their passport revoked and then you go to the airport and you're basically screwed.
Oh yeah, there's all kinds of examples of that still, like throughout the world. Yeah, that's the key difference there, is that, you know, it being a decentralized system, you know, you actually do retain control over this. Right? No one else can take that away. It's mine, right? You know, I have control over it. The only way I'd lose control is if I had lost control of my private key. That was that was maintaining control of the DID. With great power comes great responsibility, right?
Right. I think there's a saying where if you can be your own bank, you have to do your own compliance and security.
That's exactly, and right? That's right.
So, but like going back before we get off topic, is that like being decentralized makes sure that it's censorship resistant, throughout like what we were talking about? Because I think all of this forms the foundation of a lot of the stuff we talk about with self-sovereign identity. So, you know, if you can be censored based on who you are, what you've done, it doesn't really fall into that lines of being self-sovereign. It's kind of like one of the foundations of enabling that vision too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there's some other like issuing authority that can just take that away, you know, we already have systems like that. Yeah.
It's just the current system that we've had.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. So that's kind of like a quick overview of DID. So the four points of it to work, it has to be persistent, basically permanent, non-reassignable, and basically once it's on chain it has to stay there. Two, resolvable, basically to be useful based on different resolutions that can make it actionable. Three, cryptographically verifiable, so can you actually prove that you own the keys and you are who you are? And then four, decentralized, because it has to be censorship resistant. So we'll go into some more technical details of DIDs in the coming weeks when Carlos is back, but that's just a primer on how kind of our paper-based systems haven't really changed in the last 100 years or so, and so how this new digital system really has to kind of come online, because everything we do now is so digital, online, and you know, how do we make this identity system transition to that? That's kind of like the big question that we're all trying to answer here, and we're trying to build too. So thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining, Ben. And then
thank you
guys in another week or two.